Hello, welcome to the bonus episode of The Rest is History, and we are recording this on the 19th of July in a boiling hot London where the temperature is nudging upwards to about 63 degrees. Everything's melting, it's all carnage. I'm sat here surrounded by fans, but heroically I've turned them off to record this episode because I'm afraid it's only me today. Dominic is not here. He's away on holiday. He deigned to join us last week from his island in the Baltic. But this week he has gone to somewhere nice and cool, Greece. And in fact, yesterday he sent me a photograph of a large statue of Alexander the Great. And I messaged him and said, would you like to send perhaps an Alexander-themed best wishes to the Wangs? And his reply was, and I quote, "Hello, best wishes." So bless him. I hope he's having a good holiday. I hope all of you out there who may or may not be in the heat wave are coping. We have several things. Basically, this is going to be quite a short episode, I think, because obviously we don't have Dominic's pearls of wisdom here. However, we do have a pearl. We're being joined by a pearl in the form of Dom. So last time, Dom, that Dominic was away, we got Jack on to reveal the kind of the powers that be that lurk behind the Wizard of Oz's throne. And Jack talked something about how the podcast came into being, how it functions, all that kind of stuff. Do you want to just say a big hello to the Wangs?
Yeah, hello, and thanks for having me on, Tom. It's great to be here on that. Well, it is absolutely sweltering, as you've said. We're in the epicenter of it, I think, in London, aren't we?
Yes. Well, Cambridge always seems to get the hottest temperature, but or Luton or Heathrow, so maybe we're just kind of on the borders of it. But it is really, really hot. Dom, one of the reasons for getting you on is not just so that you can hold my hand, so that the poor listeners don't have to cope with my voice, but also because we are in the middle of the episodes about London are going out. So we've done five episodes, and three of those, as those of you listeners who've already taken advantage of the incredible offer to listen to them ahead of everybody else will know, are kind of standard ones, very much like the 12 Days of Christmas, Dominic and me each choosing a place, a person, an event to talk about. But there were two others where we actually went out into the streets of London, didn't we? So we did one on Roman London, on Londinium, and then we did another basically going around Smithfields and its environs and looking at some of the ghosts, the martyrs, the Dickensian figures, all the drama of that area. And we've had a number of questions about that, about basically how easy is it to do them. So what are your thoughts, Dom, on the challenges of doing a kind of episode out on the streets as opposed to just doing it in the studio?
Yeah, I think they're really enjoyable ones to do. I think where we started where we met in that kind of trendy coffee shop, didn't we, on London Bridge for the Londinium episode. But I think it's important. You did a really good job of planning them to a T. I think we had about, was it 10 stops that we needed to hit? Yeah. It's normally fine. I feel like we didn't get heckled at all. We didn't have any, I think towards the end of the Haunted London one, we had a few oiks by the Bill Sykes pub shouting at us, so we had to do a few pickups there, but they generally go quite smoothly. I think doing it in this temperature would be a completely different...
Yeah, so we did this in what, was it February or March?
February, so it was fairly cold, and we had quite a lot of people on Twitter when we posted about it going, hang on, these weren't recorded this week.
Yeah.
But so we recorded those in scarves and...
Well, because you put up some photos, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And we're all kind of wrapped up in scarves and coats and things. So I don't think you had to be Sherlock Holmes to realise.
No, I think some people felt a bit sort of robbed of the fact they weren't they weren't recent recordings, but most people seemed quite happy with that. But yeah, it's in terms of production side of things, we normally have, I was there doing the sound and recording, just checking the levels. And then we had Jack and Tony, the executive producers, walking alongside us as well, sort of Jack making sure none of the passers-by and tourists crashed into us in the City of London, and Tony often just pointing up at things going, what's that, so we make reference to it.
Because we'd also done one on Christmas Carol, haven't we, just before Christmas?
Yes, you, myself and Tony and Dominic.
So we'd had a kind of dummy run for it then.
Yeah, we did, to be fair. And I thought that one went really well, although I think Dominic was like 40 minutes late and sort of hating the whole idea of London with this delayed train. So.
Well, and of course, also the main problem with recording these episodes was that Dominic, following in the footsteps of the Kaiser, was wearing the wrong shoes. So he'd come all the way up to London wearing his shiniest shoes. They were new. I don't think he'd ever worn them before. And he had to walk about 5 miles. And honestly, the moaning and whinging, and by the end, the general sense of humour failure was quite something to see.
Yeah, I think if you plotted a graph of his sort of involvement from the Londinium episodes towards the Haunted London ones, you could see quite a clear drop-off as the shoes kicked in. But I feel slightly that I'm on your side with this one, because you were there in your hiking boots. You knew what you were in for. It was two London walks, whereas Dominic had I think he had an engagement in the evening, didn't he?
He did, yeah. He had to go give a talk in the evening.
A talk. So I think he made his bed and he decided to wear the shoes that would be appropriate for the talk. And it did somewhat stilt him.
Well, so on the Roman wall, I put up some photos of the stretch of wall in the car park. And a number of people replied to that by saying, goodness, it's a lot more impressive than Dominic's reactions led me to believe. Because there was pretty much no reaction from him. He was his lack of enthusiasm for looking at Roman's brickwork by that point had plummeted through the floor. But actually, that stretch of wall is amazing. So if you're in London, if you ever get the chance to see it, do go and see it. Because I think that's possibly the most extraordinary chunk of Roman remains anywhere in London.
So that's in the London Wall car park, isn't it?
Yeah, the London Wall car park, yeah.
When did that happen? Because surely now they wouldn't be allowed to build a... So did they find it when they were...
It's the 50s.
So they found it when
they
were...
The Mithraeum, because in the wake of the Blitz, there was so much damage done. They had to go down, dig up foundations, and they kept finding all this kind of stuff. And obviously for the developers, it was a nightmare. I mean, it's the last thing you want. But everywhere you go, you're digging this stuff up. I mean, that's why it's so that's why it's been so difficult in Athens or in Rome to build a subway system. Because everywhere you go, there's kind of priceless remains. Slightly less so in London, obviously, but even so here as well.
Yeah, actually, when I was living in Madrid and by the Royal Palace, they tried to dig this sort of underpass, and they turned out they found this huge Roman atrium, and it delayed delayed works by about three years.
Yeah, so... other questions, interruptions from passersby or pod fans? There were a few pod fans, weren't there? Was it James? Somebody stopped us actually on London Wall just before we went into the...
Yeah, we were stopped by a Wang, and I think he was really excited to see one of you. And then we said, oh, we've got the other one here as well. And he went, oh, yeah.
So, see, I can't remember which way around that was.
I won't reveal which way around it was. But poor guy, I think he must have been waiting for a shout out for quite a while, because we said, oh, this will be in the episode. And then he's had to wait about...
Well, he's had it, I think. He's had
6 months. Yes, he has.
And is it easy to replicate the conversational dynamic that we are more used to achieving over Zoom? I think so. Yes, I think so.
I think it is in terms of, but I think as long as we acknowledge where we are, and I think people are more than happy to put up with a bit of sound and background noise, because there are a few, as you said, in there, some ambulances and things. When you're in the City of London, it's expected.
Yes, the history police.
The history police. Yeah, you need to explain that. What was it?
Excellent joke. Well, so the siren went by. I said, oh, explained that, you know, there's a police car, ambulance, whatever it was. And Dominic said, it's the history police. But we avoided arrest, thank God.
And just in terms of chronology, I think we did it. It was mostly, we cut out a bit of the walking, but I think on the Londinium episode, we recorded the Gherkin bit. What was that?
That was the last bit, but we recorded that previously.
Yeah, but I think most of it was chronological. So people can plot their route.
So, I mean, one thing to say about that, the idea of focusing on the history of a particular city or place. I mean, on the Discord, let us know what you think about it as a format. Because, of course, if you do like it, it would be one that we could very readily reproduce. So obviously we can do it for other cities, and perhaps you would like to nominate cities that you think would be particularly suited to that approach.
Definitely, and ideally not Chipping Norton, which is where Dominic wants to do the next Chipping Norton week.
He wants to do Oxford, doesn't he? He does want to do Oxford. But I mean, you know, we could look at further afield than that.
Where are you thinking, Tom?
Well, I'd really, really like to do Istanbul.
Oh, yeah?
Push the boat out. That would be amazing. There'd be so much to do there. But we, you know, European capitals would actually, I mean, you know, pretty easy to get to.
Paris, Madrid would be great.
Athens, Berlin, Amsterdam. I mean, all kinds of opportunities. So let us know whether you'd like to see us do that.
Just in terms of how you plan for it, Tom, you'd done a lot of these in lockdown, hadn't you, these walks? Or did you have to kind of research each one, or did you know a lot about it anyway?
So before the lockdown, Sadie, my wife and I were, we got very, very into following the line of buried rivers, the lost rivers of London. So the Thames obviously is the great river, the famous river that everyone's heard of, but it was fed by all kinds of other rivers that come down from the hills, both north and south of the Thames. And they've basically been dug over. I mean, very, very few stretches of any of them that are still open.
And could you explain why are these rivers covered?
Because they become sewers, basically. So the most notorious one is the Fleet, which gives its name to Fleet Street. And Fleet Street crosses, Fleet Street, which, you know, became synonymous with the British press. But it was Fleet Street crossed the River Fleet just before Ludgate Hill, which is where St. Paul's is. You could sail right the way up it, you know, well into the 18th century. And Swift, Jonathan Swift, gives a kind of monstrous account of how loathsome the Fleet was. It's full of kind of dead dogs and entrails and dead babies and things, kind of things just chucked in and being swept out. So very, very kind of dangerous, spreading typhus, all that kind of stuff. But their traces are still kind of evident if you look for them. So it can be that, you know, you press your ear to the cover of a sewer, and you can hear the rushing of the waters beneath you. Or it can be in place names like Fleet Street. You know, you will often kind of see, I don't know, Meadow Road or something like that, Acre Lane.
Like the Ephra in Brixton.
Yes, exactly. So reminding you that this was once next to the river. So meadows, banks, all that kind of stuff. So one of my favorite examples of that is if you come from Mayfair. So Mayfair is, for those who don't know, London is probably the grandest, poshest area. So it's the most expensive area, is it? Is it the most expensive area on Monopoly? Park Lane, isn't it? Yeah, so it's very, very kind of swanky, developed in the 18th century. And most of the streets are kind of broad enough for cars to go along. But there are some that aren't. And the reason for that is that the River Tyburn flows through it. And in the 18th century, when it was originally developed, a bit like Amsterdam, the kind of the paths next to the canals, little paths were built next to this river. And when in due course the Tyburn got covered up, the resulting roads are too narrow for cars to go down. So they're still pedestrian. So you can go off Oxford Street and you can follow the line of these very kind of narrow streets. And you're exactly following the line of the Tyburn. And it kind of winds and twists its way through Mayfair. And then it comes out onto Piccadilly, which is this great shopping lane. It's got Green Park on it, heading down towards Buckingham Palace. On the eastern side, you've got Piccadilly Circus. And on the western side, you've got Hyde Park Corner. But when you come out, having followed the line of the River Tyburn, you realise that you're at the bottom of a river valley. And I had never thought of Piccadilly as being spanning a river valley. Because you look up towards Piccadilly Circus, you look up towards Hyde Park Corner, and you can see that these are higher. And you realise that you're at the bottom of this river valley. It became addictive. And we did more. We did all the famous ones, say the Fleet, the Tyburn, all those kind of ones, the Ephra. But then we kept more and more kind of obscure ones. And we did that throughout the lockdown. But also in the lockdown, because if you remember, the only thing really you were allowed to do to go out of your house was to shop for essentials or to take exercise. And initially people thought that you could only have an hour of exercise, but that turned out not actually to be the law. It turned out that you could have as much exercise as you wanted, provided that you went on foot from your front door and came back to it. So you couldn't kind of drive off to a beauty spot or anything. That was when people were beaches. That's when people were getting into trouble. But you could walk from your front door and go as far as you wanted. And so we, Sadie and I, just ended up doing enormous numbers of walks. So the first one we did was I dared myself to watch 28 Days Later. You've seen that? The kind of Danny Boyle zombie film.
Yeah.
Where a virus gets released and everyone in Britain kind of goes down with it. So it was a topical thing to watch. And there's a kind of famous opening shot where, what's his name? Killian Murphy, I think it is. He wakes up in St. Thomas's Hospital on the south side of the Thames facing Big Ben. And he walks through this empty hospital and there's nobody there. And then he walks out onto Westminster Bridge. Nobody there. Walks down Whitehall, nobody there. And we thought it would be fun to go and replicate that. So we got up very, very early, got there in time for dawn. And it was, you know, the city was dead. It was silent and still. It was the most apocalyptic thing. And that gave us a taste for it. So the next thing we did was in The War of the Worlds, H.G. Wells' great novel about the Martian invasion. And towards the end of it, the Martians have conquered London. Everybody's fled. And the narrator returns to London to see what's going on there. And he ends up in Putney. And he decides that he's going to walk from Putney to Primrose Hill to see what's going on. Wells gives such a detailed account of the route that he takes that it was possible to follow in the narrator's footsteps pretty exactly. And it's full of detail, like kind of all was silent. Nothing moved save for a crow. We reached South Kensington. Nothing stirred. And again, it was incredibly eerie because you were reading this in this famous apocalyptic novel about disaster taking over the world. And then all around you was the evidence of a kind of matching disaster.
Did it bring you down a bit at all? It's quite on the nose.
No, it was thrilling. I mean, of course it was. I mean, it was unsettling, but it was thrilling. It was the most exciting walk to do. And we ended up on Primrose Hill because that's in the novel is where the Martians have made their base. And famously, they die because they catch a cold. they get infected by the microbes. They don't have immunity to it. So again, kind of very topical reason for a Martian invasion to end. And the narrator stands on Primrose Hill, surrounded by the corpses of the Martians. And he looks out over London and he says that this will return back to life. And that's what we did. We stood on, you know, looking out at silent, dead London and thought, well, it will come back to life. And so it has come to pass. But as part of that, I started doing kind of themed walks. So we did ghostly London, that kind of thing, animals London. But I also did historically based ones. So I did the walk around Roman London, which basically I took Dominic to the selected highlights. And I'm sure if Dominic's listening to this, he will be appalled to know that there are even more tedious stretches to look at. And then Anglo-Saxon London, which I talked about in the episode about Barking Abbey. I did medieval London. I did Tudor London. I did Stuart London. Yeah, so I thought that was kind of interesting way to look at the history of the city. But I think that it would work equally well with other cities too. I mean, why not?
Do you think, would you recommend people temper their expectations for these tours around London in comparison to other cities where it's a lot more visible?
I think you have to use your imagination. I mean, there's no question about that, particularly in the city, because the city, as we said, has been devastated by the Great Fire and then by the Blitz. So it's not preserved in the way that other historic cities might be. But, you know, there is plenty to see. And if you use your imagination, and there's plenty of historical buildings, whatever, that have survived across the span of London. I mean, I think London is an infinitely fascinating city to explore on foot.
And we didn't really touch on it in the episode as much, but has conservation of these things been as good? The London Mithraeum and the Bloomberg building seem to be a good example of it. But as you said, in the 50s, when they discovered the London Wall, was there ever a period where post-war people were very reckless? And
people have always been interested in the archaeology of London. And so it's always been quite well preserved, basically because there isn't that much of it. So if you're in Rome, you know, you've got so many ruins around you that you become a bit blasé about it, perhaps. In London, it's that bit more precious. But I think in the 50s, the need to redevelop London was felt to be such that, of course, you'd save the Mithraeum, you'd save the stretch of London Wall, but it was a pain. And if you could dump the Mithraeum on a kind of busy road, which is what they did, then you could build your kind of 50s monstrosity, or you can build the car park around the stretch of wall without destroying it. That's what you do. I think now, you know, apart from anything else, there's more money, there's more resources for it. Archaeological techniques have developed. The infrastructure, you know, excellent infrastructure centered on the Museum of London exists with experts who can ensure that valuable finds are treated with the respect and care that they deserve. So I think the situation is much better. And you know, we didn't go to see the Mithraeum itself. We didn't go to the Guildhall. We didn't go to the stretch of the wall that runs by Tower Hill, which is really very, very impressive. So there are quite impressive things to see that we didn't go to. So I wouldn't want to give people the impression that there's nothing, you know, that it's all just kind of lumps of rock. But I think that the kind of the fragmentary elements are precisely because they're so fragmentary, they're better suited to purely audio.
Definitely.
Because you can say there is a rock and then you have the opportunity to describe what was there.
If it's a more visible tour, it wouldn't be quite the same, would it? In that
then
sense.
You have to describe it and people might feel frustrated that they're missing, you know, not able to see it. So I think that works. Right. Sam has rounded up various people's comments on past episodes. So we got Love Island and Orwell. So let's just do, I'll read out the comments on Love Island and Orwell. So Giacomo 97 talking about Love Island. The Venn diagram of Love Island fans and the rest of history is probably quite small. Thanks for making me feel seen, guys. You're welcome. We could mention at this point, am I right that that you and Jack were approached by the official Love Island podcast about the episode? Is that right?
Yeah, I believe it was a Love Island podcast. I'm not sure if it was the official ITV one, but there was, yes, yeah, a mooted idea of a collaboration. But it seems like, to be fair, it had legs of its own, our Love Island one. Some people were saying that it was their favourite episode ever and that they might go and watch Love Island as a result, which I'm not sure would be the the most logical course of action.
Well, again, I mean, maybe we could have thoughts on this from people, whether you would like to have this as a kind of annual event to coincide with Love Island when it comes on every summer.
Some people alternatively did say we'd jump the shark with this episode, which I thought was in some ways high praise. It's taking us 200 episodes and then a Love Island episode to be
yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it's basically, it was an episode that was, I guess, devoted to the regular listeners. Because quite a lot of people have said, you know, what about Cleopatra, Ragnar Hairy Pants, suggesting Cleopatra should have been on it. Tim G, sad that Helen of Troy didn't make it. The reason that the kind of real celebrity lovers from history didn't make it was that they were too obvious. And the premise from the point of view of doing it as a history podcast rather than as a parody of Love Island was essentially, it was an excuse for Dominic and myself to give the Potter biographies of 10 figures from history who people might not necessarily be entirely familiar with. So that was essentially the justification for it from the historical point of view.
And do you have any feedback from Katie? Because obviously she was away when we recorded the results episode. Has she commented on it at all?
She was appalled at how posh she sounded and could only bear to listen to the first half. But I think all her friends liked it. So that's the main thing. And I thought she did wonderfully on it. So quite a lot of people wondered about Judith not being put to the public vote and were sad that a relationship with Virginia Woolf didn't develop. But I thought Katie played that very well.
If Judith got to a public runoff, all hell could break loose, I think.
Yeah. But also the solemnity with which she said that she couldn't really see Judith and Virginia Woolf making a go of it. And I thought that showed immense responsibility and care to the evidence. So I was very proud of her.
I think so. And I think Dominic would have been a bit too happy if Virginia Woolf and Judas had managed to triumph, I think. So it was good that Katie foresaw that.
It was wonderful for Dominic. Theodora and Stanley Baldwin. I mean, that is truly the couple of his heart. So very, very happy for him. So that was Love Island. And then one of the reasons for doing Love Island was simply so that we could pair it with an episode on George Orwell. Because I thought that you could not imagine two more different topics, two more different approaches. So I was absolutely thrilled to have them in the same week.
How would George Orwell have got on, do you think, if he was a part of Love Island?
He'd have been terrible. He'd have hated it. He'd have absolutely hated it. And he'd have kind of...
Do you think him and General Gordon would have just sort of marched off to a corner?
I think they would. Yes, I think they would. Poor old General Gordon. Poor old Gordon. So comments on Orwell. Tony Bang, I thought Robert Coles was fantastic. He absolutely was. Would be great to sit down and have a pint with him. Reminded me so much of the older guys I used to come across in the local working men's clubs who knew their stuff and would tell great stories. Simon Girdleston didn't agree with all of it. Simon likes Orwell's novels in the 1930s. He even likes Burmese Days, which Orwell himself later renounced. One thing I thought got rather taken for granted, but shouldn't be, is just how good his prose is. How taut, concise, and to the point without compromising the ideas he is conveying or picture he is painting. And I think that is why journalists love him so much.
Yeah, the feedback for Orwell was incredible. I mean, we might have to revisit him, to be fair, further on in the podcast, because I think we touched on him with Jason Cowley, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we could do a whole episode on, say, 1984. I mean, we didn't really go into it in great detail. And the awful truth is, I haven't read 1984 since I was about 16.
So tell us about that. You read it and you were so petrified.
No, I had the book. I had the book. So I'd read Animal Farm and then I got the book, but it just looks, I kind of read the first few pages. I was so frightened by it. I found the idea of this kind of, you know, dystopian future so unsettling. I kind of hid it under my bed. And then every so often I would dare myself to look at it. And the only other book that I've ever done that with is an edition of Oliver Twist with I think it's Cruikshank's illustration of Fagin in his death cell, where he's sitting on a bench kind of gibbering with terror. And again, so I would kind of, in the middle of the night, I'd dare myself to go and look at it. Very, very frightening. I did end up reading it. I found it very unsettling, and I haven't read it since.
When, not to give any spoilers for 1984, but so if you haven't read it, turn off now. I felt this with the Agatha Christie episode. I've read a few Agatha Christies, and Dominic
blew it all.
What a great podcast it was, but we did sort of proceed to ruin every single Agatha Christie book. But in 1984, I remember the moment you sort of find out O'Brien isn't who you think he is. I think it was one of the most shocking moments of my childhood reading it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it really has that power. But we were on the specific point of his prose. I do think that, you know, the Orwell Prize, which is given to basically journalists who want to be Orwell. You can't imagine any other writer inspiring a prize like that.
So why do you think there is this absolute loving with him in that way than journalists these days would like to be sort of the modern version compared to other writers of his time?
I think because of the feeling that he's kind of honest, that he's principled, that he follows awkward truths to their kind of logical end point. And I think that he just writes with this kind of incredible clarity. So I think all those reasons. And Sarah Carey, who I think is a Irish journalist, she says she liked the episode very much. A point on how prophetic he was. One, on 1984, enforced surveillance. We have total surveillance, constantly tracked our movements, opinions, health stats, purchases, photographs, etc. But it's all done by consent, not imposed. He didn't foresee that we would be bribed, not forced into surveillance. And actually, that's a kind of... So Dominic touched on how Orwell was taught by Aldous Huxley at Eton. And of course, that's Aldous Huxley's insight. She says that Huxley's dystopia is much closer to reality. A population distracted willingly by recreational drugs, legal in the case of alcohol, and luxury and personal entertainment, watching cat videos on YouTube, successfully politically inoculated. Well, there's nothing wrong with cat videos.
I think, wasn't it that George Orwell, he sent like a proof copy to Aldous Huxley. And then Aldous Huxley said, yeah, it's great, but I think you should read this one that I wrote much better.
Well, upmanship. Okay, well, so thank you very much for listening. Dominic will be back next week, and we will kind of, we'll talk more about the London episodes then, and anything else that comes up. I'm sure we might talk about hot weather, we'll talk about Dominic's holidays, all that kind of stuff. So we will see you then. A huge thanks to Dom for standing in. Always good to have a Dom.
Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. So we'll see you next week. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.